Modi's visit to Russia. We know he's after his re-election. He's going to be in Russia in his first visit to a foreign country. And what's the importance of this visit and what they're going to talk about, Modi and Putin?
Well, it's important in terms of the optics of it because Modi isn't rushing off to Washington, and that is very easily explained because India is trying to distance itself from the fiasco that Washington has become, and there's nobody for Modi, there's no counterpart for Modi to talk to. But there's a big reason for him to go to Moscow right away, which is that in India-Russia trade needs quite a bit of help. Exports from Russia to India are booming, and a lot of that is oil, which the Indians are now refining and shipping on to other parts of the world, particularly Europe, the European Union, and taking a share of the profits, of course, refining profits. But the problem with that scheme is that India doesn't export to Russia as much as Russia exports to India, and Indian rupees are just piling up as far in Russia's foreign currency reserves. So that is a problem that needs to be addressed. And what they'll be discussing is ways of improving India's exports to Russia. And Russia's investments into India's economy. That will be the main topic of discussion. And also all of the activities surrounding the BRICS summit and all of the activities surrounding BRICS in general. I'm sure they'll be talking about moving on to the new BRICS bridge, which is the new payment system where different countries will be able to quote unquote coin digital currencies backed by their own currencies, their national currencies, and use these in exchange via the BRICS bridge without having to actually involve banks and banking institutions, and certainly not any Western banking institutions, and certainly not on any Western toxic currencies such as the US dollar or the euro.
Yeah. How do you see this concept of the BRICS currency? How long does it take for these countries getting totally independent of the United States?
Well, if you look at Russia and China, their trade is quite healthy at this point and growing nicely. And it's being conducted in the national currencies. But that still poses some problems because the individual importers and exporters have to deal with banks, and banks are these institutions that are subject to Western sanctions. So now there are different kinds of Chinese banks, some that can trade with the West and some that can trade with Russia. That's a complicated sort of system that nobody really likes. So something like the BRICS bridge will solve that problem because importers and exporters will no longer have to deal with banking institutions, be they Western or Chinese or anything. They will basically deal with this peer-to-peer system that will get rid of the need to consider, well, whose currency are we using? Everybody's using their own currency, and it just transparently washes through the entire system.
Yeah. When it comes to the relationship with among these three important countries, Russia, India, and China, how do you see the role of Russia in bringing China and India together? They have some sort of differences, and considering their policies, domestic policies and foreign policies. But when it comes to Russia, that has a very robust relationship with China and India as well. And we know that the relationship between China and between Russia and India goes back to the Soviet Union. And how do you see the role of Russia considering the differences that we know exist within BRICS?
I think Russia has quite a bit of authority within BRICS because it did the brave thing and confronted the West head on, whereas India is not really up to doing that, and neither is China. They see the necessity of doing that. They see the train wreck that's coming with the end of the petrodollar system, the end of the dollar system in general. They see US hegemony crumbling, and yet they have all of these relationships with the West to this day that they cannot really sacrifice. And so they have to play it safe. They have to be careful. Russia doesn't have to be so careful anymore, so it can be the inspiration for everyone. As far as the different tracks within BRICS, there's the question of security, that is separately discussed. There is the question of finance and economic growth, which is separately discussed. And there's the question of education and culture, and humanitarian missions, which is yet a third component. And so instead of doing the Western thing and applying military discipline to finance and corrupting any type of cultural relationship by insistence on Western quote unquote universal values, these are all kept separate. Okay, so soup comes separately from salad. You don't throw your salad into the soup and stir it all together. So that approach shows a lot more hope than what the West has been trying to do. I think that in terms of all of these problems that the West was able to foment between, for instance, India and China over the years, we'll have to deal with the fact that it's not a universal approach. Are you trying to talk about finance? Are you trying to talk about security? You can't talk about both at the same time. And if you're talking about humanitarian issues, then that's separate from the both of them. So that is a bit of a shock to all of the people in Washington and Brussels, who are used to stirring it all into one big boiling pot of God knows what. But it has a lot more hope, I would say.
We have elections in the West, in Europe, and in the United States. Recently, the Russian officials, they're talking about that they're not interested in that much interested in what's going on in the United States. But they are keeping an eye on what's going on in France. And what's the importance of France in your opinion?
There is no importance to France at all at this point. France is, at this point, a has-been of a country. Its industrial might, it rests on its very, very old and creaking network of nuclear power plants. It has lost access to the uranium reserves in Niger that it was previously using. It has lost the ability to economically build new nuclear power plants. So it is endlessly extending the lifetime of the existing ones, which is not really a good thing at all. Overall, I don't see France really playing that big a role moving forward in international affairs. It's a minor bit player. In terms of the elections in France, well, it's a majoritarian system where you have a couple of parties on the left and a couple of parties on the right. And if it looks like the right is winning, then the left, one of the parties on the left kind of bows out of the particular election and spoils it for the right. So the right can never win. It would be rather surprising if the right manages to win this time around. It would be very, very uncharacteristic. But it's going to be a mess either way. It's just going to be a very, very hard to govern country, especially considering that no matter what happens, the people on the left are not going to be pleased. And when the people on the left in France aren't pleased, they tend to break a lot, smash a lot of windows, and cause a lot of mayhem, which we're seeing already, and we'll probably see even more of it.
But do you find that when it comes to the conflict in Ukraine, do you find that the left wing is better than the right wing, or they are all the same? It doesn't make that much of a difference.
Nothing really makes that much of a difference. I think that there was an attempt by Macron to talk out both sides of his mouth at the same time. He was either sending troops to the Ukraine or not sending troops to the Ukraine, sending weapons, not sending weapons. He was trying to pursue the strategy of strategic ambiguity, ambiguïté stratégique. Which I think is the only value of that strategy is that it sounds good in French. That's about it. But it's otherwise a fiasco. So I don't think it makes any difference at all who wins there or what happens. I believe that Le Pen would want to limit the damage, seeing as there's no victory to be had in the Ukraine. But it's she will discover. Just like her counterpart in Italy has discovered, Giorgia Meloni has discovered that her politics don't matter at all. She just, okay, she got elected and that was in order to pretend that there's democracy in Europe. But now that that democratic exercise is over, she has to follow orders or somebody's going to shoot her plane down or something. But she won't live very long. And she knows that, she was told that, and I'm sure the same thing will happen to Le Pen if she ever gets into any kind of a position of authority.
Yeah, Orban just visited Zelensky. He wanted to convince him to go after some sort of ceasefire and to go after some sort of political settlement. But it seems that Zelensky was rejecting, his administration was rejecting all the suggestions on the part of Orban. And we know that Zelensky recently was talking about that we cannot continue this conflict and for years, because that's not possible with the level of casualties, with the level of destruction that is happening to to Ukraine. And how do you find it right now? Do you think that Zelensky wants to negotiate? Because we've heard that Azov Battalion was threatening Zelensky, if you go, if you want to negotiate, that would be the end of your term in Ukraine. How do you find it, in your opinion? What's going on?
Well, the money is drying up, and if there's no more money to steal, then there's no more Ukraine, because the purpose of the Ukrainian government is to steal the money that is being given to them. So Zelensky is trying different ploys. So, okay, losing militarily and throwing lots of meat at the front line and watching it get massacred is not really causing his quote unquote partners to throw even more money at him. Let's try something else. Let's say that he's willing to negotiate. Let's see whether he'll get more money that way. But I don't think that's going to work either, because there just really isn't that much money and that many weapons, and the whole thing is a disaster anyway. In terms of any actual negotiation, well, who is he? Who is Zelensky? That's the first question to ask. And if you say that he's the president of Ukraine, then you clearly aren't up on the Ukrainian constitution, because he's expired. He is a squatter. He doesn't belong in that chair anymore. And furthermore, the only official bit of the Ukrainian government left is the parliament, the Verkhovna Rada, and that's only legitimate until August 11th, at which point the Verkhovna Rada turns into a pumpkin, and there is no longer any legitimate federal government in the Ukraine, and power devolves to the regions, which at that point can hold referenda and decide whether they want to form some kind of a union with each other, or whether now that the Ukrainian constitution is bye-bye, or maybe they can join the Russian Federation instead. That's really the choice up to is up to them. You know, they can make that choice of their own free will. So Zelensky saying that he wants to negotiate is a lot like saying that I want to negotiate here. I, Dmitry Orlov, will negotiate peace in the Ukraine. About the same sort of position, I would say.
Yeah, but when he talks this way, do you think that he's under pressure from the West to talk about these things, or he's just talking about what he's thinking right now?
I think that, you know, he has some people who write his speeches for him, and they try to earn their keep somehow. They try to make themselves look useful, even if they're not very useful. So I don't think he's coming up with those ideas himself. He's like a Joe Biden. He reads from the piece of paper that's handed to him. So I don't know that it means much, but he's already in trouble because of that. Just by saying that he wants to negotiate with the Russians, suddenly a lot of these Nazis have come out of the woodwork and have been threatening to kill him. So that sort of peaceful stand doesn't really make it very far in the Ukraine until it's completely denazified. And it's pretty far from being denazified because denazifying the Ukraine involves making the United States look really, really, really bad. To so bad that even the Ukrainian Nazis, who are really thick people, who are not very smart, will realize that they've been had, that they've been fooled by this entity called the United States that deserves no respect whatsoever, that is an absolute treasonous entity that has killed lots of them for no good reason and has fooled them all along, and that the enemy is not Russia, the enemy is America. So once the Ukrainian Nazis decide that the real enemy is America, Russia will have won.
Anthony Blinken just said that he's gonna improve, they're gonna improve the air defense system of Ukraine. There was an article in Bloomberg talking about that NATO is not capable of supporting Ukraine for years. And when you see all of these mixed messages coming out of the West considering Ukraine, do you find it that they're gonna put an end? Let's assume that Joe Biden wins. Do you think that he's capable of continuing this conflict, or he's willing, let's put it this way, he's willing to continue this conflict that he knows that nothing would come out of this conflict that would be beneficial for the United States?
Well, that's really not true. What's beneficial for the United States is the arms business, and the arms business is doing really well. And it's not a requirement that the Ukraine wins at all. In fact, they'll waste more weapons if they're losing than if they're winning. So the fact that they're losing means more profits for the military defense contractors, not less. There's a mosquito in the camera. And so that's just fine. And also, who the hell is Joe Biden anyway? You know, he's some animatronic thing, you know, that spews nonsense. Nobody knows who runs America, and nobody even knows whether anyone runs America at this point, because it's a bunch of special interests, and the combination of them could very easily become just completely ungovernable. I don't think that that's a good sort of thought pattern to follow. I don't think it ends with any clarity. I think that this will go on until it stops making any sort of sense to the people behind it, and those are the people who are dead set on defeating Russia no matter what, no matter how crazy that sounds. And then there are a lot of people making profits off of them by spending money on weapons. So as long as everything is happy in that neck of the woods, the slaughter in the Ukraine will continue.
There are a lot of people in the West, including Orban from Hungary, that they hope that if Trump wins, he's gonna change the situation in Ukraine. When you look at the Trump's presidency in his first term, he was putting a lot of sanctions on Russia. He was sending weapons to Ukraine. He continued to send weapons to Ukraine. And we had the INF Treaty. He just withdraw from INF Treaty. These are huge changes that has happened during Trump. Do you, in your opinion, when you see people are talking about that Trump would solve everything, that everything gonna be so beautiful when he comes to power, what's your take on Trump and the way that he's gonna be in power, and what would be the outcome for the conflict in Ukraine?
Well, first of all, American presidents are never in power. They're in office. It's a technical job. The first thing that happens to a naive young president, who don't exist anymore, by the way, but suppose there was a naive young president. Well, he got elected, and his first briefing at the White House will be on the subject of what to do in order to avoid getting shot. And what not to do specifically in order to avoid getting shot. So you don't touch the Pentagon's budget. You don't touch the Federal Reserve. You play carefully with Wall Street, and you do whatever Israel tells you to do. And those are the basics. So there are very strict constraints, and most people, especially older people with very limited attention span, who don't really have very much respect for the truth, are likely to not do much. They'll just sort of posture in front of the camera when asked to do so. Most of what they'll say will be focus group tested to see what idiots like to hear, so that the next time it becomes necessary to make believe that the United States is a democracy, the idiots will line up and do what's expected of them and not pull any surprises. But there isn't really any difference between U.S. presidents. If you look at their foreign policy, if you look at many parts of their domestic policy, except for the particularly divisive little issues like abortion, which are especially contrived to be divisive to distract from the real good. Presidents don't do anything. They sign pieces of paper drafted by somebody else, and they read words off of a piece of paper composed by somebody else. The United States is not a democracy, and it doesn't matter who is president. That is a mantra worth repeating over and over and over again.
In your opinion, what's going on in Europe? Whoever you talk about that, we have a the way that you talk about the United States, the political system, and we know we all talk about it, is a cabal, is a deep state, is a establishment behind all of these decisions that are happening right now in Gaza, in Ukraine. And do you think that they would be in favor of the right-wing parties in Europe or left-wing parties or people to the center? Which right now, when you look at the current situation, the political parties in Europe, in these people in the United States who are deciding about everything in G7, in NATO, in your opinion, who's better for them, for their policy in Europe?
Well, first of all, the people the deep state, so-called, or there isn't an adequate name for it because we don't know who these people are. The one thing we know for sure about these people is that we don't know who they are. They make sure that we don't know. And as far as the politics, the left wing, the right wing, the middle wing, whatever it is, the important thing as far as the secretive people who run things behind the scenes is that none of these political organizations follow the will of the electorate. So they will do whatever it takes to deflect or create subterfuge or create some kind of mayhem or internal contradiction or friction or whatever it takes to make sure that the will of the people expressed through voting is not registered in terms of government policy. They and in different under different circumstances, it might take different tricks. They might even support a communist party. Who knows? But there isn't really a functional system, political system, in either any of the European countries or in the United States at this point. It's all just games people play to make sure that people keep out of the way of those who decide things for them.
But when I'm talking about the European Union right now, do you think that we're getting to the point that these people, these nations within the European Union are just perceiving that the policy of the European Union doesn't represent their domestic policy, their national policy? Do you think that we're getting to that point?
Well, yes, I think some small number of people might realize that, of the ones who actually won't bother to think about that. And here's the thing to try. Try to get your national sovereignty back. The way to do that is to get the Americans to get rid of all of their army bases on your soil. Just get them all to pack up and go home. So do that, and then we'll talk. And until you do that, you're an occupied country. Your country is a nothing. It's a figment. It doesn't exist. It can't make any decisions on its own. It's an occupied territory.
Yeah. And when it comes to Gaza, shifting the talk to Gaza and what's going on, right now it seems that Netanyahu is he just want to attack he just want to attack Hezbollah. And the United States is talking about that in the coming weeks he may attack Hezbollah. And do you think that Biden is interested in what Netanyahu is going to do, or he's not capable of changing Netanyahu's mind on this issue?
Does Biden know that Gaza exists? I mean, seriously. Where in his brain is Gaza? So again, I can't imagine him thinking deeply and productively on the subject. In terms of what's going on, Netanyahu is trying to pull the American military into a conflict in the Middle East. The United States does not want to be pulled into yet another conflict because it's already wasted all of the resources it has on the Ukraine, and if it wastes even more resources on the Middle East, just as unproductively, then what will it have to offer to Taiwan? It might as well just fold as far as any future conflict in Taiwan. So if the United States does what Netanyahu wants it to do, which is join in the fight against Hezbollah and Iran, and there are people in the United States who salivate at that prospect, of course. But at that point, China can just basically say to the Taiwanese, please come along quietly and don't make too much noise. And the Taiwanese will do it because they will know that the United States has absolutely no ability to help them in any way at all. So that is really the what's going on. And the reason Netanyahu wants to enlarge this conflict is because it can't solve the existing one. The little operation against Hamas has failed spectacularly, and now it's an ongoing mess. So if you can't solve a problem, enlarge it, is the dictum, the old saying. And by and large, what Netanyahu thinks he should do is start a conflict with Hezbollah and with Iran. Of course, Israel has already been defeated by during its last incursion into southern Lebanon, but there's no reason why it wouldn't try that again. And the whole reason that Netanyahu is trying to do that is because he wants to stay out of jail. He wants to stay in power, and he wants to stay out of jail. And if he fails at doing this, then his political future is non-existent. I think that Israel is really going to fall apart. It is already falling apart. The fact that they're trying to draft Orthodox Jews into the military, to me, that's hilarious. I mean, that's just the funniest thing in the world. Can you imagine, this order of battle? Of course, Hezbollah will attack on Sabbath, and at the same time, you have all these Hasidim in the trenches going Shabbat Shalom, Shalim Bom Bom, and holding hands and dancing around because that's what you do on a Sabbath, and there's no way to stop them. So I think that will be the order of battle if Orthodox Jews get drafted in Israel. But that is such a sign of desperation to try to get to militarize that contingent. You have to be borderline insane. But and yet we see it happening. So we see Orthodox Jews protesting on the streets of Jerusalem. Hilarious.
They're against these policies of Netanyahu. They're not happy with these policies, but nobody seems to care about them. And there's just nothing for the Netanyahu administration and these Zionists in Israel.
Well, they should pay a little bit more attention because it's 10% of the Israeli population. And as the Israeli population dwindles because all the smart Jews are getting out, it's going to be an ever larger part of the population. And this part of the population is pacifist. They believe they should devote their efforts to studying Talmud and keeping the commandments and all of that. They're not interested in war at all. And the way things are going, I see a large section of the Israeli population sort of saying, okay, maybe they're a little crazy, but the fact that they don't like Zionism and the fact that they think that the existence of a contemporary Israel is blasphemous, because it contradicts prophecy. Maybe they're onto something. Maybe we should pay more attention to them. So, getting them riled up is always the wrong move because these are some of the most stubborn people in the world. And I think Netanyahu has pretty much blown it by trying to draft them into Tzahal.
Yeah. When you look at the Saudi Arabia right now, just to wrap up this session, Dimitri, Saudi Arabia, and we've learned that the United States was offering a defense treaty to Saudi Arabia in order to normalize the relationship with Israel. But it doesn't seem that policy is working, and Saudi Arabia is just getting closer to China and Russia right now. And how do you see the situation with Saudi Arabia? We know that they have a lot to lose if they go against the United States because their reserve is in dollar. That's why they're trying to manage their relationship with the United States. But At the end of the day, do you think that is the United States is getting ready to force Saudi Arabia or even Turkey with everything it has, sanctions, I don't know, economic pressure, and to bring them back into an agreement, some sort of agreement between them and Israel?
No, I think that, they blew it. I think that the Hamas action has put an end to that entire train of thought, if you will. In terms of being able to put pressure, United States being able to put pressure on Saudi Arabia. Well, the thing is that because of the petrodollar, the United States and Saudi Arabia has been pretty much joined at the hip for a very long time economically. And if the United States decides to hurt Saudi Arabia can hurt it right back, because the amount of dollar denominated wealth that that Saudi Arabia has accumulated can be very quickly depreciated if the Saudi rulers decide to make a move, which they can, because they're despots, they're royalty, and they have complete command of everything within Saudi Arabia. It's a family business. And unlike the United States, where you have a lot of shadowy players that have to talk to each other for a long time, and the planets have to align before the United States does anything decisive. And most of the time, by the time it does something decisive, it's too late and it can't make force adjustments, and it's just bumbling along. It's in Saudi Arabia, it's just down to one person who can be very nimble. So I think some people in the United States realize that that's in fact true. And so we'll be careful. And as far as Turkey, there is this, it's not really a secret, it's a worst kept secret, which is that very few people, either in the Turkish elite and government or in the population at large, harbor any good feelings for the United States. They really, really hate the United States at this point for producing not one but a couple of different attempts to overthrow the government, for attempting to kill their president, for doing all sorts of underhanded things to hurt Turkey. So I think that again, as long as things are a little bit civil, because Turkey is still part of NATO and plays its part. But if the United States goes out of its way to antagonize Turkey, things could go south very quickly from that point on. And again, I think some people in Washington do understand that they have to be careful.